You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 23rd of May 2012 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House on Monocle 24, live from Studio One in London with me, Emma Nelson. Coming up in the next 60 minutes, they're rattling their sabres in the South China Seas again. We have the latest on the dispute between Beijing and Manila. Also today, what's this man got tucked away in his bottom drawer?
Oh, well, we'll have a look, see if I can find a few medals. These are all at least world, European and national. I don't think I've got anything lower.
We'll be telling you what that man's so good at that he's a world champion later on in the programme. And after research shows that trust is growing towards the UK and its people, we assess what happens when soft power trickles down to the man in the street. All that, plus a bit of Paris shopping Japanese style. That's all coming up here on Midori House on Monocle 24. But before that, let's get the latest news headlines from around the world with Nick Kelly.
Monocle 24 News, I'm Nick Kelly. Egyptians relished their first free leadership vote today, with Islamists pitted against secular figures in a contest unthinkable before a popular revolt swept President Hosni Mubarak from power 15 months ago. With no reliable opinion polls, no one knows who's likely to win the presidency, but Egyptians revelled in the uncertainty after the routinely rigged votes of Mubarak's 30 years in power. Journalist Joseph Dana, who spoke to Monocle earlier, explained what the feeling was like on the streets of Cairo.
The atmosphere is extremely exciting, and I think you can really see this clearly in the candidates' field right now. And so what's most interesting about the election that's happening is that the candidates are kind of ideologically scrambling at this point. And we're seeing a lot of very interesting connections being made across the political spectrum.
World powers and Iran have held unusually detailed talks about how it could show its nuclear work is not a disguised quest for atom bombs in a Baghdad meeting aimed at halting a slide towards a new Middle East war. The EU foreign policy chief, Catherine Ashton, is leading a proposal that addresses concerns over Iran's uranium enrichment to a concentration of 20%. Her spokesman, Michael Mann, told reporters not to expect big decisions at today's talks.
We hope that the Iranians will respond positively. We can make progress today. This is the second in a series of meetings. It's a process. You're not going to get dramatic happenings today, I don't think. We're going to make solid progress if things go well.
World stocks tumbled and the euro fell to a 21-month low today on worries about Greece's possible exit from the eurozone, which would deepen the region's debt crisis and hurt an already fragile global economic recovery. Greek leaders arrived in Brussels ahead of an EU summit where heads of state will try to breathe life into their struggling economies. Among them, the former Greek Prime Minister and Socialist Party member George Papandreou.
Because we want to see a transparent Greece, a competitive Greece, a dynamic Greece, a just Greece. And we want to remain in the euro. But we also need time and understanding. And we need understanding that this is a wider crisis. It is a crisis where we need to go beyond name-calling and scapegoating, and we need to collectively pool our strengths.
The British Prime Minister David Cameron said Greece's economic problems and speculation about its possible exit from the euro are the biggest risks to world economies. He was addressing Parliament ahead of the crisis meeting in Brussels of EU leaders.
The future of Greece is for the Greek people to determine. It is for them to decide what is best for their country. But I don't believe we can afford to allow this issue to be endlessly fudged or put off. The Greek election should, in effect, be a straightforward choice between staying in the eurozone with the responsibilities that entails or taking a different path.
A Pakistani doctor accused of helping the CIA find Osama bin Laden has been jailed for 33 years for treason. Shakil Afridi was accused of running a fake vaccination campaign, believed to have helped the intelligence agency track bin Laden in a Pakistani town where he was killed in a US Special Forces raid last May. The imprisonment is likely to anger Washington at a sensitive time when it has engaged in talks with Pakistan over reopening NATO supply routes in Afghanistan. And the World Health Organization has said spikes in radiation caused by the Fukushima nuclear disaster were below cancer-causing levels in almost all of Japan. But infants in one town appear to be at a higher risk of developing thyroid cancer. The earthquake and tsunami on March the 11th, 2011, wrecked the plant, triggering nuclear meltdowns that contaminated food and water and forced mass evacuations. Nearly 16,000 people were killed and 3,500 remain unaccounted for. Those are the top stories here on Monocle 24.
Thanks very much indeed, Nick. It's 5 minutes past the hour. You're listening to Midori House here on Monocle 24.
The head at Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
Dobro pozdravljavat, Monocle 24.
Essa è Monocle 24.
Detta è Monocle 24.
Están escuchando Monocle 24.
Das ist Monocle 24.
Monocle 24
this. This is Monocle 24.
Hasta en tu Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
And our first story on Midori House today concerns the increasing standoff on the Scarborough Shoal. The Chinese have increased the number of ships near to the disputed Scarborough Shoal in the South China Sea. It may not surprise you to hear that that claim is being made by Manila. Fishing, utility and Chinese government boats are all thought to have been in the area of the South China Sea, which both countries claim as theirs. Well, to bring us the latest and give us an assessment of where this might be heading, we turn now to Alessio Patalano, who's an Asian naval defence expert at the Department of War Studies at King's College London. Welcome back to Midori House, Alessio. 3 weeks ago, we were talking about the headline in the Manila Times telling the Philippines to prepare for war. What's happened in the interim?
This is an ongoing, this is a new arc of an ongoing sort of drama that has been unfolding now for about 2 months. And of course, this is a new step, but falling within the parameters of what we've seen so far. This is a game in which both countries are attached to the idea, or they are claiming the sovereignty of this particular area. So the presence of fishing boats there from both sides, the presence of constabulary forces on site in this area, these are all statements of where their position is. And in a way, this is also something that says a lot about the fact that let's not take the eyes off the ball. Just, you know, let's keep the eyes on the ball while we're trying to figure diplomatic negotiations.
Now, Manila claimed that 96 Chinese vessels were spotted in the relevant area, and obviously a lot of them were fishing, which is what the Chinese are in theory banned from doing. How credible is this claim?
Well, there's two things to say about this. Well, first of all, that of course, that the according to ANCLOS, the shoals are within 124 nautical miles from Luzon in the Philippines. So technically they are part of the Philippines EEZ as it is defined in ANCLOS. But of course, that is not an overriding legislation. Countries that have overlapping claims have to find a way to negotiate sort of like common positions about borders. So in this case, the Chinese claim sovereignty over the shores, which brings us to the situation as it is at the moment. The presence of the fishing boats, even though Chinese fishermen are interdicted to be there because the Philippines claim the area as part of its EEZ, this is contested by China. So the fact that, you know, fishing boats are there is part of this contested claims ongoing between the two parties. Now, coming to the specific point about the nature of the boats, reports are pretty unclear at the moment. It talks about government ships. Now, that could mean many, many different things. One element of the story is also that the presence of governmental ships coming from agencies that are entitled, that they are indeed part of the law enforcement, the constabulary forces that operate at sea to regulate how fishermen behave, that could be also an element to try to avoid any sort of escalation or any sort of accident from happening because of the presence of such a high concentration of fishing boats in such a small place.
You talk about trying to avoid an escalation, but am I right in thinking that some individuals, some patriotic Filipinos, have been trying to launch their own patrols too? I'm speaking in particular of a gentleman called Nicano Faeldon.
Absolutely, yes. Well, this was reported, I think this was part of the news that was aired today, about this is a former Filipino Marine Corps captain who tried to organize sort of a personal expedition with a few crew members to get there to the shore. Now, first of all, there's an important point to make. This is not like a tourist destination sort of island. We're talking about a group of shores, so it's not the place where you can actually land ashore and spend a few lovely days as you would see in Pirates of the Caribbean or something. This is a completely different situation. These are inhabited small rocks, so to speak, which are very important because of the properties that the waters and the tides create at the very rich sort of grounds for fishermen. So it's very much of a symbol, it's a symbolic action, in fact, to go there, show the flag and make a point about what belongs to whom. The more important point, however, is that the presence of the fishing boats, the Chinese fishing boats there, by the very nature, as you mentioned a few moments ago, the act of an individual, I think that the presence of governmental assets is very important specifically to try to avoid that. So while the government, in a way, cannot really stop an individual from trying, individual fishermen to go there, they can certainly try to make sure that their behavior does not create any more problems. And I think in this particular instance, the Filipino government was particularly good in handling the situation with this former Marine Corps captain by avoiding, because eventually he organized the expedition, but he didn't put it into action, which is, again, a sign of the fact that the Philippines and the government of the Philippines is still very much in control of the situation.
It is in control of the situation, but it had to stop this gentleman from going out there. I mean, obviously, this is a sign that the government is trying to sort things out peacefully, but alternatively it could be a sign that people are now feeling so wound up about this that they're deciding to take matters into their own hands. Or is this just a lone man acting by himself?
Well, I think in order to find the proper answer to this question, once you try to contextualize on what this shoals and in particular the way this overlapping claims are evolving, what is the meaning within the different domestic context? By that I mean one has to try to contextualize how political parties are using the Scarborough Shoal incident at the moment to play a particular political agenda. Now, that's very much a debate that has to do within the Philippines, and it's taking place within the Philippines, and it's taking place within China. And it has less to do with the other country and more to do with party politics and domestic politics in both countries.
You talk about the politicians there. Haven't Philippine politicians decided to rattle sabres before? I'm speaking in particular to do with, is it Pagasa Island last year?
Yes. Well, exactly. I mean, that's exactly the point that I was inching towards. And this is the sort of situation. Last year, conservative elements of in the Philippines had tried to use this other incident as a political incident. And again, I suppose that here the key element is, if you want, the key element in this story is the sort of pressure that both the government in the Philippines and in China are facing at the moment. Because on the one hand, they have territorial claims, they're trying to continue a diplomatic negotiation, but at the same time, they have to try to handle a certain sense of unrest within their own domestic audiences, which, of course, put that into a context less of the politics and sort of like the diplomacy of the issue, and more into the symbolic value related to the pride, the honour, the international standing of the country.
And finally, there's been a news report in, I think it's the Manila Times, that's quoting the Foreign Affairs Secretary, saying that some countries are helping Manila establish a minimum credible defence posture to complement its diplomatic capacity. Obviously, this has the very, very strong military overtones. Can we assume that that is the United States? And if so, would the, as I asked you 3 weeks ago, I'll ask you again, do you think the US would actually back up Manila if push came to shove?
I think it is very much in the interest of the United States to try to help the Philippines and China to work their way out without resorting to the use of military force. Because, of course, by the 1951, as we mentioned 3 weeks ago, there is a defense agreement between the Philippines and the United States. And so it depends very much on the scenario, of course. It depends who's going to fire the first shots, et cetera, et cetera. But at the same time, for this very reason, because of the existence of this agreement, it's very much in the interest of the United States to try to avoid at all costs that the current situation escalates into something that is more problematic and definitely going to resort to the use of military force.
Alessio, thank you very much indeed for joining us once more. That was Dr. Alessio Paterlano from the Department of War Studies at King's College London. The time is just creeping up to 16 minutes past the top of the hour. You're listening to Midori House.
On the latest edition of Section D, we sit down with Sir Paul Smith to hear why he collects rabbits. We hit the controversial orbit in London's Olympic Park.
The Olympics is showing Britain to the world, and this is saying that there is a certain spirit of invention in this country.
And we talked to the founders of Wanted Design in New York and Pin-Up Magazine in Berlin. We also talk retail in Stockholm and Riverside Revival in Paris.
That's Section D with Hugo MacDonald, premiering every Tuesday at 1900 hours UK time, right here on Monocle 24.
In Tasmania, talented craftspeople are making use of the island's natural materials to design and build furniture and ceramics. Monocle video journalist Gabriel Lee toured the island to meet the designer makers putting Tasmania's personality on the map.
It seemed to me that if I was going to make pots at this time and in this culture, I needed to say something about being here and now. And the way to do that was through the materials.
You can watch this and many more Monocle films from affairs to business, culture to design in the programs menu on monocle.com.
Welcome back. In just a moment, we'll be talking trust and how much it counts on an internationally cultural level. But first, some music. This is We Own the Sky by M83. And that was M83 and We Own the Sky. You're listening to Midori House. Welcome back. There is a now, albeit rarely used, saying that the sun never sets on the British Empire because God wouldn't trust an Englishman in the dark. But it appears that that may well have changed, because research suggests that the United Kingdom and its people are more trusted than ever. But what does that mean? Well, to explain all, I'm joined by the utterly trustworthy Ben Page, Chief Executive of Ipsos Mori, the organisation which did the research. Ben, a very warm welcome back to Midori House. Lovely to see you again. We are the British are more trusted than ever. What does that mean, and who trusts us?
I think what it means in a globalised world, particularly for a country like Britain, which isn't like Germany making cars for the world, where we have to trade with people and sell services, being trusted is vital if we're going to play our way in the world. And obviously it's important for all countries. This study has been done for the British Council. But I think it's a reminder that particularly Britain, with the English language, with its education system, and indeed its sort of, non-tangible cultural assets, to use posh words, means that probably we should remember those things. Because what we've done is look at young people, educated young people all over the world in countries like Russia and China, Brazil, but also Pakistan, Poland and Turkey. And we've looked at how they feel about the British, how they feel about the Americans, how they feel about the Germans. We could have gone on through an endless list of countries. We looked at those three. And what it shows is that people who've done some sort of cultural exchange, perhaps even just learnt English to read Monocle magazine, gone to visit an exhibition, those people tend to trust us more, even after we've allowed for the fact that all of these people in our survey are young, they're the people who are going to be running these countries in the future, they're all well-educated. When you control for everything else, the people who've taken part in cultural activities, have learned English, are more likely to trust us, more likely to say they want to invest here. And it appears that the more they do these sorts of things, perhaps, find out about Britain, the more they like us. And I think that's important. That doesn't apply to all countries.
You mentioned there that the subjects were what? The United Kingdom, the United States and Germany, and countries that were asked, numbered among them were places like Russia and Poland and, where was it again, Pakistan. Countries which one would argue have a fairly antagonistic history among a lot of them. So is it that surprising that the United States is slightly, the United Kingdom is slightly more trusted than the United States or Germany?
Well, I don't know. Why should the Spanish trust us more than the Americans? I mean, we're nearby. I don't know. We've got Gibraltar. They don't like us for Gibraltar. The Brazilians probably do far more trade with the Americans than they do with Britain. But I think, the Saudis, for example, again, trade with both of us. I think it just says something about Britain's place in the world. But it's also what the key thing in it really is not so much whether Britain is up or down versus Germany. And it's interesting to see the long hand of the Second World War. No, we couldn't find anybody in Poland who said they trusted the Germans, even 60 years on after the end of the Second World War. And this is amongst young people who weren't, none of them were alive at the time. Most of them have grown up post-communism. What's interesting, I think, is more this difference about cultural exchange. And it's just perhaps a reminder for Britain that things like the World Service matter, things like the activities of the British Council matter. I mean, we spend billions on defence, we spend billions on putting troops in the ground around the world, we spend millions and millions on aid. And actually some of the non-tangible things, broadcasting, journalism, professional services, all of these things actually also count towards people's willingness to invest. You know, we need the Brazilians to invest in us, we need the Chinese to invest in us. And if they think we're more trustworthy than the Americans, that's good.
So were there any specific criteria by which you could measure trust? Because it's an incredibly hard thing to quantify.
I think that's a fair point. I mean, although it's a concept, albeit a vague one, that most countries would sort of recognise. And of course, it's multifaceted. I mean, at the very crudest, will these people do what they say they will, or will I have to sue them or chase them in some way? But there's also a whole load of a sort of associations wrapped into it. And, the people who trust Britain are much more likely to see us as tolerant, open, and indeed some of the things that, despite the fact that we like to beat ourselves up, we perhaps have become. One thing I found interesting in discussing this work is just a reminder about how interconnected the world is. And one of the challenge British politicians have, who of course, in the recession that we're in, as in so many of the Western democracies, where we need to trade our way out of it, and we need to open up and trade more with the rest of the world, given that Britain still does more trade of one of its near neighbours, Ireland, than it does with India or China, is that you can't just say one thing for a domestic audience and one thing for a global audience. So when the Prime Minister says that there are parts of Britain that are frankly sick following the riots, and we talk about those and how everything's going to the dogs in Britain, that isn't a great advert for doing business with us, although I think, people keep a sense of perspective.
And when you talk about making business work and happen and making the United Kingdom work on that level, do you think a price, an actual figure, can be put on trust?
It's You can certainly try and work out the values of brands. I guess you could try and work out the value of brands of countries. It would be an incredibly arcane position. I just think it means that people are more willing to buy some of your products and services. I mean, a classic one is British exams. People will pay, you know, money to the Cambridge Exam Board, because if you get that, you know, you sort of know it will be properly and independently. You will have more currency in the world, I'm afraid, than if it was perhaps a Brazilian exam board. Or possibly even an American one.
Were there any areas where the United Kingdom was perhaps not as trustworthy as it could be?
We haven't really done it in quite that way. I think what it just reminds us all the time is that you know, there are these assets there, and we neglect them at our peril. So cutting the British, BBC World Service, for example, we may none of these things happen at once, but. It, overall, our position, we punch above our weight in the world, not because although we're still the seventh largest manufacturer in the world, which you wouldn't believe every day reading British newspapers, but we punch above our weight because of our legacy, because of our heritage, because we were once, over 100 years ago, the most powerful country in the world. And as we've declined in relative terms compared to other economies, you know, people, that sort of stuff stays behind. We've perhaps developed along the way a sort of slight sense of irony and a bit more humour than we might have been seen as when we were just about gunships blazing in the late 19th century. But this is just a timely reminder that the intangibles matter, the soft stuff matters. As Tom Peters, the management consultant, put it, the soft stuff is the hard stuff. And it's another reminder about that. We neglect it at our peril.
So do you think, very, very briefly, because time is running out on us, that governments and businesses are capitalising sufficiently on this? I mean, I'm thinking just loosely of the fact that the Olympics is coming this year, and the British have been very good at making themselves appear to be very indifferent towards it in many ways. You know, they don't care that the Olympics is coming. They're quite bar humbug. But in actual fact, they really should be going out there all trumpets blazing.
Well, I think, and although to be honest, that's partly that the media like to say that the British public doesn't care. I think what you'll see both in the Jubilee and after that, the Olympics, is a massive outpouring of patriotism. There'll be the newspapers sort of knocking ourselves as normal. But actually, I think we'll be pretty different. And actually, business does already do things like sponsor orchestras to travel the world and promote Britishness. And it's perhaps just, I spoke last night at an event on this with Sir Roger Carr, who's the head of the CBI, the Confederation of British Industry. I think British business does wake up to this, but it's just a reminder of the intangible stuff. It isn't just about getting out there. All of the associations that people have about Britain in the world are still very, very positive, and sometimes more positive than we would see ourselves.
Ben, thank you very much indeed for joining us. That was Ben Page from Ipsos Mori. You're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24.
Vous écoutez Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
Detta är Monocle 24.
Essa är Monocle 24.
Das ist Monocle 24.
En a Monocle 24 tagat, ja.
This is Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
Monocle 24 är jag som.
Tämä on Monocle 24.
The Propa Jalavet, Monocle 24.
Esto es Monocle 24.
After I met on Monocle 24.
The hat at Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
You're listening to Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
Stay with us here on Midori House, because in the next half hour we'll chat with our culture editor Robert Bound about table tennis and singing Yorkshireman in the latest edition of Monocle, and we'll see what fashion brand Uniqlo is up to in Paris. Before that, let's get the latest news headlines from Nick.
Thanks, Emma. Egyptians relished their first free leadership vote today, with Islamists pitted against secular figures in a contest unthinkable before a popular revolt swept President Hosni Mubarak from power 15 months ago. World powers and Iran have held unusually detailed talks about how it could show its nuclear work is not a disguised quest for atom bombs in a Baghdad meeting aimed at halting a slide towards a new Middle East war. World stocks tumbled and the euro fell to a 21-month low today on worries about Greece's possible exit from the eurozone, which would deepen the region's debt crisis and hurt an already fragile global economic recovery. A Pakistani doctor accused of helping the CIA find Osama bin Laden has been jailed for 33 years for treason, a move likely to deepen strains in ties between Washington and Islamabad. Lebanese Foreign Minister Adnan Mansour has said that Lebanese Shiites kidnapped in northern Syria by insurgents hoping to trade the captives for detainees in Syrian government custody would be freed soon. Saudi Arabia, concerned that chaos in Yemen would further embolden al-Qaeda on its own doorstep, pledged $3.25 billion in aid to its neighbour at a donors' meeting 2 days after more than 90 Yemeni soldiers were killed in a suicide attack. African Union and Somali government troops stepped up their assault on al-Shabaab militants in Mogadishu's northern outskirts today, forcing hundreds of families to flee their makeshift homes and head for the city centre. And the World Health Organization has said spikes in radiation caused by last year's Fukushima nuclear disaster were below cancer-causing levels in almost all of Japan, but infants in one town appear to be at a higher risk of developing thyroid cancer. Those are the top stories here on Monocle 24.
Nick, thank you very much indeed. And Nick will be back at the top of the hour with a full roundup of today's news headlines. Well, every day this week on Midori House, we're chatting with the writers and editors behind the stories featured in the latest edition of Monocle magazine, now out of the newsstand and should have arrived on your doorsteps by now, ladies and gentlemen. Today we're joined by Monocle's culture editor, Robert Bound, continuing the stripe theme that's currently being displayed on the editorial floor upstairs.
I know, everyone got the facts this morning, didn't they? Fresh through their fax machine.
Yeah, I didn't get the facts.
You didn't get the facts.
No.
You were just very...
Plain. But no, you're smart. Very smart.
I don't know. Everyone seems to be wearing stripes. Stripes and navy.
What's the Breton Mafia have taken over the editorial catwalk?
There was a comment on Facebook that said, "This looks like is this the Breton Eurovision entry?"
You're going to Eurovision.
It's just quite camp enough.
Are you going to Eurovision?
I put the brakes on that.
Oh, what a shame.
I know. Sorry.
What a shame.
I can tell you nothing about Baku.
Don't worry about it.
This time next week, Emma, I'll still be able to tell you nothing about
Fantastic.
Baku.
Fantastic. We'll meet back and we'll have another check-in
exactly.
with
How
each
was
other.
Baku? Didn't go?
No idea. Okay. No idea. Not got a clue. What can you tell me about?
First of all, I wanted to draw your attention to, the culture briefing section in Monocle, which was that is page 143. And that was a joy to boss last month or for this month's issue. One of the best films I've seen in ages was a documentary called Ping Pong.
Right.
Which is, they've sold it really badly, this film. I mean, it's out now. It's sort of out in time for the Olympics. But it's got a very boring name. You would never know from the name Ping Pong that it is about people, these charming octogenarians competing for the over 60s. But this particular film follows the over 80s section of the table tennis world championships.
I'm assuming this is a documentary.
This is a documentary.
Right, this isn't this isn't made up. This is
Robert De Niro does not star.
This is that I wouldn't
So Ian McKellen does not star.
Oh. That's a remake, isn't it? Once it hits Hollywood.
Derek Jacobi's in it. No, he's not.
Oh.
I think of old geezers, I like it.
Keep going. So it's a documentary about 80 plus year olds who play ping pong.
Yeah.
Right.
Ferociously.
And you wonder why perhaps it hasn't been given the star billing.
You'd have thought they could find some. People probably put their answers on a postcard and write in to Monocle to provide their alternative versions of what this film might be called. But Ping Pong, anyway, it is. And it is this most amazing, charming. It does sound a bit sort of too cutesy to be true, but it's a phenomenal film. It's genuinely dramatic. It's really moving. These people are sort of, they seem to have forgotten how old they are. They're incredibly competitive, quite vicious. There's an American lady who started off as a Czech lady who sort of fought for the French resistance and did all these sorts of things and still has the same sprightliness and candour and sort of athletic rigour that she presumably had when she was in her 20s, kind of making friends with German soldiers for the good of France and greater Europe. Anyway, she continues with this vim and vigour as she kind of
She's
ends
narrowed
up
her sight slightly.
Sort of, yes.
I don't she's want to concentrated spoil, her efforts.
Yeah, I don't want to spoil the movie, but she does very well in this championship.
Wow.
And there's an Aussie who's 101-year-old Australian woman who rocks up and is sort of like the belle of the ball. And as I say, too cutesy. It is an amazingly good film.
We played a little bit at the beginning of the programme to give everybody a taste of what it was all about. It sounded very understated, though. Should we have another listen to it?
Yeah, this is Terry, who's one of the main protagonists. There are sort of, I think, eight protagonists. Terry is, I think he's a Yorkshireman, and he's rocking it.
Oh, well, we'll have a look, see if I can find a few medals. These are all at least world, European, and national. I don't think I've got anything lower.
Will he win in China?
That is in the lap of the gods. We might just reiterate one or two of those verses, that if you think you're beaten, you are. If you think you dare not, you don't. If you'd like to win but think you can't, it's almost sure you won't. You know, etc. Life's battles don't always go to the stronger or fitter man, but sooner or late, the man who wins is the man who thinks he can. And to think I can, I will have to train hard.
Nobody had expected to live to 84, and here they are playing good table tennis.
Terry sounds like the gentleman who you meet by chance. You don't have a great deal of patience when you first meet them, but at the end of them, you've suddenly worked out how life should work.
Yes, yeah, exactly. And this, yeah, he's really wonderful. He's sort of, he's a chipper Yorkshireman. I think that the thing that we heard on the clip there is a BBC Radio Leeds interview that was conducted, and I seem to remember from the film he turned up to the interview in like sort of shorts and a polo shirt and a sweatbands, and
he's battle ready.
Yeah, he's exactly battle hardened, battle ready, battle ready. And he's one of the stars. He goes quite far, and I think he has a sort of a Swedish nemesis, a sort of Blofeldian arch rival that follows him through to the final of this octogenarian table tennis world championship.
The little clip I've seen. They don't really look fast enough to walk across the room, let alone play competitive level world class ping pong. Am I doing them a disservice there?
You are. Well, you sort of are. Yeah, they are. I think they do this sort of like, you know, they're a bit like Super Grand. Do you remember Super Grand? There's something for all our listeners. They are sort of like incredibly doddery until they get the competitive glint in their eye, and then they turn into these kind of lean.
The angina's forgotten. The rheumatoid arthritis is gotten. Sciatica is a thing of the past. Right. Okay.
There is quite a lot of wheezing. I mean, I think there's not like a blooper tape on the, when you buy the DVD of this movie. There won't be a blooper tape. There'll be a sort of wheeze extra. There's a lot of that and a lot of like, ooh, me back.
You can't hear the hip replacement.
Exactly. There's a lot of that sort of stuff.
We'll move on to something else in a moment. There's something that I noticed about in the little clip I saw was that they're all wearing big red. Are they hats? Are they sweatbands? What is it with the outfits?
Well, Terry here in the picture, who we heard on the clip, here there's a picture of him in the magazine. He's wearing a big red. That's a big red.
He's
headband.
Also topless.
Yeah. Well, he used to be a bodybuilder in the 50s, I think, after the war. He was one of these. I think he was a sickly child, so he grew up to want to be a He-Man.
Right.
You know the type. I don't know whether you know. I didn't mean it. That wasn't a loaded question. I don't know. That wasn't a loaded question. But we possibly know the type.
Yes, no, of course, yeah. Of course. And he's the kind of man that you... Those were He-Mans. I'll just get out my old Rolodec out later and just look under H.
Yeah.
No, he's the gentleman, the kind of gentleman that you realise, you know, you've not done remotely enough in your life. And when you see someone like that.
I know. And all of them even just... I mean, most people that age wouldn't even get on a plane to China, let alone get on a plane there, dress up in sports gear and fight to the death for the love of ping pong.
We've talked a lot about the wonderful characters in this film. What do we know about the director?
There's two brothers. I think Hugh Hartford is the director. His brother is the producer. And I think they both... it's like a first... I think it's a first-time film. I think it was it's a sort of Olympic... It's part of the cultural Olympiad. I think it's a sort of Olympic commission. These sorts of things, as you know, can often be quite soft and very sort of like didactic and good news story and all the rest of it. This is a good news story, but sort of accidentally. It's pretty... It sort of reminds me of a really great film that was made about the Junior Eurovision Song Contest a couple of years ago, which is absolutely amazing as well. And it's one of these subjects that, you know... I guess kids and old people have either greater wisdom than we do, or less, less schooling, I suppose, in how you're meant to be on the TV.
Where's this film going to end up? Is it going to never achieve the greatness that you think it deserves, or do you think word of mouth might?
Yeah,
just
well,
push
this
it?
Is why I'm glad. Well, this is why it's nice to have an opportunity this evening to talk about it. You know, because it's one of those things that I guess will be a sort of word of mouth success if it is a success. I think it'll be like a DVD success, although it will obviously be. I think it'll be on theatrical release in the UK. Around the time of the Olympics kickoff and around the time this magazine is relevant, which is now, hopefully. Maybe we got there slightly before.
Oh, well done, Monocle.
Yeah.
You brought some music to play us. Are we doing the Dow Yorkshireman, or what are we?
We're going to talk about Richard Hawley.
Lovely.
We chatted, didn't we, before we turned on the mics about how much we like Richard Hawley.
We did. We do like Richard Hawley. He's sort of, I was trying to work out when I listen to Richard Hawley, and it's generally when driving along a rainy motorway.
Well, there you go. See, that's the is to paraphrase Timmy Mallett. This is the show your TV was made for. That's the music that it was made for, right?
Yeah.
That's sort of what it sounds like. Mm. His new album is called Standing at the Sky's Edge. Richard Hawley, formerly of Pulp, and now he's been solo for I don't know, 8 or 9 years. Again, a Dour Yorkshireman. He's the sort of king of the Teds. He's a teddy boy, isn't he? Slick back hair. What you might call brothel creepers.
The man you'll find in the pub at 10 past 11.
Yeah. And he's quite gruff.
And he'll have just made friends with Terry.
He will have made friends with Terry. I can imagine them sort of like after a few ales, arm wrestling, but quite quietly, without a fanfare around them, in the corner, for money.
Can we hear a bit of this arm wrestling?
We're going to hear a... It's kind of like quite a kind of... There's some big widescreen production on this record. It's quite psyche and it's quite big. This, however, is a slightly sweeter song and it's called Seek It.
And that was Richard Hawley and Seek It on Monocle 24, as recommended by our culture editor, Robert Bound. The time is 15 minutes towards the top of the hour. The Japanese clothing brand has made a rather special announcement in Paris today. It held an unusual press conference at the Ritz Hotel. Well, our man in Paris, Tom Burgess Watson, was there, and he explained it all to Monocle's Tom Edwards.
I'm sitting in the Uniqlo flagship store here in Paris, which is quite close to the Opéra Garnier, and it's next to all the big department stores like Galeries Lafayette. And if you're a shopper in Paris, you'll probably know where I'm talking about. And the sun is definitely out, and so are the tourists who are wandering around in droves, and French people too, because this shop seems to be quite a hit here in France. And one of the things on display are these rotating mannequins, four of them wearing rather summery clothes, donning Panama hats, and in their glass cage with them are all these tennis balls. So obviously getting into the summer season, and we've got Roland Garros, the French Open, just a few days away, and it seems tennis is quite a big theme at the moment here at Uniqlo, because all the monitors are showing games of tennis being played on them. So it's a festive scene here, a summer festive scene here at Uniqlo in central Paris.
And Tom, I gather, continuing that tennis theme, the Japanese brand had an exciting announcement to make about a big new tie-in.
They certainly did. They were making a bit of a splash today at the Ritz, and it was almost quite literally, because the event that they were holding was being held on the boarded over swimming pool in the underground basement of the Ritz Hotel at Place Vendôme. And that, I have to say, made me feel a little uncomfortable when they told me I was sitting on top of a swimming pool. But the whole Uniqlo management team was there, amongst them the chairman and the president and CEO of the company, who's called Tadashi Yanai. So I thought, well, if he's there, we're probably safe and we won't fall through the floorboards into the swimming pool, which is good. But they had an exciting announcement to make, and it's a connection to sport, and particularly to tennis, because at that conference today at the Ritz Hotel's swimming pool, Uniqlo announced a rather special new partnership.
Here at the Ritz Hotel, Uniqlo has chosen tennis player Novak Djokovic as its global ambassador.
So there you have it, the head of Uniqlo, Tadashi Yanai, Japan's richest man, announcing here in Paris that they do have some expansion plans, but they also had another announcement to make, which is that the world number one tennis player, the Serbian Novak Djokovic, is going to be their new global ambassador. And they also unveiled the outfit that he's going to be wearing on the tennis courts around the world, with the global media and all the television cameras zooming in on him. So it's a pretty smart move.
And so, Tom, does Novak Djokovic have a particular link to Japan? I mean, what does the country mean to him?
That's a very good question, and I wanted to know exactly the same thing. And it turns out he hasn't actually visited Japan ever at any stage in his life, but nonetheless he says he has a very strong affinity to the country. Let's take a listen to how he answered that question I put to him.
Well, first of all, I respect Japan as a country, their tradition, their history, just their mentality, their personality of the people. They're very disciplined, very professional, very respectful. Everywhere around the world I go, wherever I meet Japanese people, they are always kind and outgoing. So that was my first contact with Japan at all. It's like a destiny, I believe, in a way, because I always had a big sympathy towards Japan and Japanese people. And now we are stepping into a new cooperation and partnership together. Hopefully that is going to last not only 5 years, but more years after that, and we're planning lots of good things together.
So that's Novak Djokovic, the world number one tennis player, telling me a little earlier on just why it is that he's so excited about this new tie-up with Japan's number one retailer. And he certainly seems to be very enthusiastic about the country. And he also mentioned the strong feelings he had after he saw the pictures of the tsunami in Japan last year, on March the 11th last year, and how much that moved him. And he also does an awful lot of things with charitable foundations. So he's a man with a big heart by the sound of things. But you might well ask, if he hasn't been to Japan before, why did Uniqlo choose Djokovic? Well, the answer is he's a huge brand. As I said, he's the world number one tennis player. Lots of big tennis events are coming up, not least the Paris Open, but then you've got Wimbledon thereafter. So I asked the company's creative director, Naoki Takizawa, to give a few reasons for that particular tie-up from their side.
First of all, he's good looking, but also because of his personality and the fact he's good at sport. But he's also dedicated to society. We have many shared values, and I think we can do a lot of things together.
So there you are, a philosophical head of the creative department there at Uniqlo, speaking about why they've picked Novak Djokovic, who's done a lot of work with his children foundations. I said he's got a very squeaky clean image. He's very mature and wise for his 25 years. He's actually younger than Uniqlo, which we tend to think of being a fairly young brand as it is, but actually Uniqlo is 3 years older than Novak Djokovic. So there you go. He's a wise young man.
And Tom, how are Uniqlo faring in France, where you are now? I mean, have they got a very good outlook there, or are they fairly measured in their expectations?
Yeah, well, looking around me, I can see long lines at all the tills, which can only be a good sign in the retail world. Lots of people wandering around. It seems to have a large number of tourists here as well. So the countries that don't have Uniqlo are obviously flocking to cities around the world that do have it, so they can stock up on all their summer clothes and so on. We asked them during the press conference today that Uniqlo gave with Novak Djokovic just how things were going in Europe. They said that some UK branches were doing well, but they said that others weren't, and they were going to be sort of having a bit of a rethink on their British strategy. But the two shops they have here in France, the one here at Opéra where I am now and the other one at La Défense, which is in the business district of Paris, both doing very well indeed. I went to the La Défense branch yesterday and had a look around that as well. And again, a smart shop with a good layout, pretty big by Paris standards, and lots of customers. So on the whole, looking good there. But whether or not they've got any other shops and openings in the pipeline here in Europe is a question that we put to Tadashi Yanai, the chairman of Uniqlo.
As for expansion plans, we'd like to open stores in all the major European cities, like Berlin and Barcelona, but for the time being we don't have exact numbers.
And that was Tadashi Yanai, CEO of Uniqlo's holding company, unveiling the world number one tennis player, Novak Djokovic, as its ambassador earlier on today in Paris, and also talking about Uniqlo's plans to expand in Europe. And before that, you heard our man, Tom Burgess-Watson, talking to Monocle's Tom Edwards from one of Uniqlo's stores in Paris. It's 7 minutes to the top of the hour. You're listening to Midori House.
Subscribe to Monocle and you'll receive 10 hefty issues and our two seasonal newspapers delivered anywhere in the world. You'll also receive our special edition canvas tote bag and sometimes even invitations to special events in our key markets. With a variety of subscription options, Monocle is available monthly from £45, and you can also order our special gift package for friends and clients who want to keep an eye on the world. Subscribe today at monocle.com or pop into our shops in Tokyo, Hong Kong, London and New York.
Welcome back to Midori House. Raul Castro's daughter is in California this week, in fact. I believe she's just landed in San Francisco. She was granted a visa, much to everybody's surprise and bafflement, by the US government. It's the latest in a decades-long diplomatic drama between US and Cuba. But what's also surprised more than one person is that Mariela Castro is a sexologist. Well, for more on this, we're joined on the line now by Andy Gomez. He's Senior Fellow for Cuban and Cuban-American Studies at the University of Miami. A very warm welcome, Andy. Before we get into the niceties of why she was there in terms of, you know, her profession, what sort of visa was she given?
Oh, she was given a visa, an academic visa, to travel to the United States to attend the Latin American Studies Association, which is held annually throughout the Western Hemisphere. It happens that this year it's in San Francisco.
And I'm assuming that this has something to do with her work as a sexologist. What was she doing there?
Well, no, I don't know what she's doing there. I haven't heard what panel she's participating, but I would imagine it has to do with sex in Latin America. I mean, what is her subject?
I understand, actually, that the paper she's presenting documents the history of sex education in Cuba and inserts sexual rights into the broader goals of the Cuban Revolution. What do you think of that?
I have no problem with that, to be very honest with you. I think sometimes, you know, the passion for some of the Cuba issues is clouded by the reality of things. And the United States and Cuba keeps playing this chess game. You know, sometimes we give visas to them, sometimes they give visas to us. I mean, I just came back from Cuba not too long ago with a visit of the Pope, and I was surprised that they gave me a visa to attend the Pope's visit, which gave me the opportunity to see and hear what was going on inside Cuba.
There has been quite a lot of criticism on the almost arbitrary nature of the granting of visas. Why do you think Mariela Castro got the visa and other academics might not have been granted the visa?
Well, there were a number of academics very well known from Cuba, most of them I know, that were just here a couple of weeks ago in Washington, D.C., attending a conference on U.S.-Cuba relations, and they were given visas to come to the United States. In the case of denying the visas to other academics to go to San Francisco, like I say, this is a chess game. I mean, sometimes Cuba misbehaves, sometimes the United States misbehaves. You just don't know how it's going to end up. In the case of Mariela, I can tell you, in the greater Cuban-American community here in Miami, we could care less. As a matter of fact, I would say if she represents, as she has, the gay and lesbian transsexual community in Cuba, well, there's much more liberty and freedom for all those groups to function in the United States than there is in Cuba. So I would invite Mariela to stay in the United States.
I think this is possibly one of the problems that the Cuban dissidents in particular have had, is that they've criticised Mariela Castro for being part of a regime which doesn't show the same tolerance for ideological diversity, not just sexual diversity.
Precisely. So, you know, it's very contradictory. I mean, so, you know, just like in your country or any country that represents, you know, and respects freedom and human rights, why doesn't Mariela stay in the United States?
There are some activists that you do a little bit of research on the internet, and there are quite a few Cuban-American activists who fled the family's regime and are quite infuriated by the fact that she's coming over and being able to speak quite freely.
Well, that's what the United States is all about. Freedom of expression, liberty of expression. And I'm sure, you know, being the daughter of Raul Castro, she probably has more freedom in Cuba than most of the Cubans on the island. But here in the United States, everybody's treated the same way. So, you know, Mariela can say whatever she wants.
You're saying that you're treating this as a chess game, which is arguably a very accurate way of describing what's been going on for the last few decades. I mean, just a few weeks ago, we had the Summit of the Americas where the United States and Cuba, well, Cuba wasn't there. But is this any indication of a thawing, perhaps, given the very, very high-profile nature of the woman who's been granted the visa?
No, I don't think so. You know, I think the United States every once in a while makes a hint to see if there will be any interest in Cuba of sitting down at the table with a common agenda. But I don't think anything is going to happen from the United States point of view until the presidential elections in November.
So really, this is nothing more than just a one-off incident then. Very briefly, I'm going to have to cut you short.
Absolutely.
In time.
Absolutely. The chess game has been going on for a long time, and I dare to say will continue for a while longer.
Andy, thank you very much indeed for joining us. That's all we have time for today's Midori House. Thanks to my producer, Daniel Giacopelli, our researcher, Fernanda Augusto Pacheco, and our studio manager, Toby Hammond. I'll be back with Andrew Muller in 3 hours' time for the Monocle Daily. Hope you can join me then. Bye-bye.